asked Abe, recovering. There won't be any. We'll talk to Ambrose like civilized people, understand? She stared hard at him again, and Abe finally shrugged in acquiescence, as though being overpowered by a woman half his age was no big deal.
Fine. We'll do it together.
Lissa was a little suspicious at his willingness, and he must have picked up on that.
We will, he said, continuing walking. This is a good time. Well, as good as any time for an investigation. Court's going to get chaotic as the monarch elections get underway. Everyone here will be busy, and new people will start pouring in.
A breeze heavy with humidity ruffled Lissa's hair. The promise of heat was on it, and she knew Abe would be right about sunrise. It would be worth going to bed early. When will the elections happen? She asked.
As soon as they put dear Tatiana to rest. These things move fast. We need our government restored. She'll be buried tomorrow at the church with a ceremony and service. But there'll be no repeat of the procession. They're still too uneasy.
I felt kind of bad that she hadn't received a full queenly funeral in the end. But then, if it meant her true murderer was found, maybe she would have preferred it that way.
Once the burial happens and elections begin, Abe continued, any family who wants to put out a candidate for the crown will do so. And of course they'll want to. You've never seen a monarchical election, have you? It's quite a spectacle. Of course, before the voting occurs, all the candidates will have to be tested.
There was something ominous in the way he said tested. But Lissa's thoughts were elsewhere. Tatiana had been the only queen she'd ever known, and the full impact of a regime change was staggering. A new king or queen can affect everything, for better or worse. I hope it's someone good. One of the Ozeras, maybe? One of Tasha's people? She glanced hopefully at Christian, who could only shrug. Or Ariana Zelsky. I like her. Not that it matters who I want, she added bitterly. Seeing as I can't vote. The council's votes determined the election's winner, so, again, she was locked out of the Moroi legal process.
A lot of work will go into the nominations,
Abe explained, avoiding her last comment.
Each family will want someone to further their interests, but who also has a chance of getting votes from...
Ugh! I was thrust harshly out of the calculating world of Moroi politics and back into the wilds of West Virginia. Very painfully so. Something solid and fierce slammed me against the hard-packed earth, leaves and branches cutting my face and hands. Strong hands held me down, and Dimitri's voice spoke in my ear.
You should have just hidden in town, he said, a little amused.
His weight and position allowed me no room to move.
It would have been the last place I looked. Instead, I knew exactly where you'd go.
Whatever. Don't act so smart, I said through gritted teeth, trying to break out of his hold. God damn it. He was smart. And once again, the closeness of him was disorienting. Earlier, it had seemed to affect him, too. But he'd apparently learned his lesson.
You made a lucky guess. That's all. I don't need luck, Rosa. I'll always find you. So really, it's up to you how difficult you want this situation to be.
There was an almost conversational tone to his voice, made all the more ridiculous by the situation we were in.
We can do this over and over, or you can do the reasonable thing and just stay put with Sydney and me.
It's not reasonable, it's wasteful. He was sweating from the heat and undoubtedly because he'd had to run pretty hard to catch up with me. Adrian wore a cologne that always made me heady, but the natural scent of Dimitri's warm skin was intoxicating, too. It was amazing to me that I could keep noticing these little things and be attracted to them, even when I was legitimately mad at him for keeping me captive. Maybe anger was a turn-on for me.
How many times do I have to explain the logic behind what we're doing?
He asked in exasperation.
Until you give up.
I pushed back against him, trying again to get loose. But all it did was put us closer together. I had a feeling the kissing trick wouldn't work this time. He jerked me to my feet, keeping my arms and hands pinned behind my back. I had a little more room to maneuver than I had on the ground, but not quite enough to break free. Slowly, he began trying to make me walk back toward the direction I'd come from.
I am not letting you and Sydney risk getting in trouble with me. I'll take care of myself, so just let me go,
I said, literally dragging my feet. Seeing a tall, skinny tree, I stuck one leg out and hooked myself onto the trunk, completely bringing us to a halt. Dimitri groaned and shifted his grip to get me away from the tree. It almost gave me an escape opportunity, but I didn't even manage two steps before he had a hold of me again.
Rose, he said wearily, you can't win.
How's your face feeling? I asked. I couldn't see any marks in the poor lighting, but knew the punch I'd given him would leave a mark tomorrow. It was a shame to damage his face like that. But he'd heal, and maybe it would teach him a lesson about messing with Rose Hathaway. Or not. He began dragging me again.
I'm seconds away from just tossing you over my shoulder, he warned. I'd like to see you try. How do you think Lisa would feel if you got killed?
His grip tightened, and while I had a feeling he'd make good on his over-the-shoulder threat, I also suspected he wanted to shake me. He was that upset.
Can you imagine what it would do to her if she lost you?
For a moment, I was out of snappy retorts. I didn't want to die, but risking my life was exactly that. Risking my life. No one else's. Still, I knew he was right. Lisa would be devastated if anything happened to me. And yet, it was a risk I had to take.
Have a little faith, comrade. I won't get killed, I said stubbornly. I'll stay alive.
Not the answer he'd wanted.
He shifted his hold. There are other ways to help her than whatever insanity you're thinking of.
I suddenly went limp. Dimitri stumbled, caught by surprise at my sudden lack of resistance.
What's wrong?
He asked, both puzzled and suspicious. I stared off into the night, my eyes not really focused on anything. Instead, I was seeing Lisa and Abe back at court, remembering Lisa's feeling of powerlessness and longing for her vote. Tatiana's note came back to me, and for a moment, I could hear her voice in my head.
She is not the last Dragomir. Another lives.
You're right, I said at last.
Right about...
Dimitri was at a total loss. It was a common reaction for people when I agreed to something reasonable.
Rushing back to court won't help Lisa.
Silence. I couldn't fully make out his expression, but it was probably filled with shock.
I'll go back to the motel with you, and I won't go running off to court.
Another Dragomir. Another Dragomir needing to be found. I took a deep breath. But I'm not going to sit around and do nothing. I am going to do something for Lisa. And you and Sydney are going to help me.
Chapter 8.
It turned out I was wrong about the local police department being comprised of one guy and a dog. When Dimitri and I walked back to the motel, we saw flashing red and blue lights in the parking lot, and a few bystanders trying to see what was happening.
The whole town turned out, I said.
Dimitri sighed.
You just had to say something to the desk clerk, didn't you?
We'd stopped some distance away, hidden in the shadow of a run-down building.
I thought it would slow you down.
It's going to slow us down now.
His eyes did a sweep of the scene, taking in all the details in the flickering light.
Sydney's car is gone. That's something, at least.
My earlier cockiness faded. Is it? We just lost our ride.
She wouldn't leave us, but she was smart enough to get out before the police came knocking on her door.
He turned and surveyed the town's one main road.
Come on. She has to be close, and there's a good chance the police might actually start searching around if they thought some defenseless girl was being chased down.
The tone he used for defenseless spoke legions. Dimitri made an executive decision to walk back toward the road that had led us into town, assuming Sydney would want to get out of there now that I'd blown our cover. Getting the police involved had created complications, but I felt little regret over what I'd done. I was excited about the plan that had occurred to me in the woods and wanted, as usual, to get moving on it right away. If I'd helped get us out of this hole of a town, so much the better. Dimitri's instincts about Sydney were right. About a half mile outside of town, we spotted a CRV pulled off on the road's shoulder. The engine was off, the lights dark, but I could see well enough to identify the Louisiana plates. I walked over to the driver's side window and knocked on the glass. Inside, Sydney flinched. She rolled down the window, face incredulous.
What did you do?
Never mind, don't bother, just get in. Dimitri and I complied. I felt like a naughty child under her disapproving glare. She started the car without a word and began driving in the direction we'd originally come, eventually merging with the small state highway that led back to the interstate. That was promising. Only once we'd driven a few miles, she pulled off again, this time at a dark exit that didn't seem to have anything at it. She turned off the car and turned to peer at me in the back seat.
You ran, didn't you?
Yeah, but I got this... Sydney held up a hand to silence me.
No, don't. Not yet. I wish you could have pulled off your daring escape without attracting the authorities.
Me too, said Dimitri.
I scowled at them both.
Hey, I came back, didn't I?
Dimitri arched an eyebrow at that, apparently questioning just how voluntary that had been.
And now I know what we have to do to help Lissa.
What we have to do, said Sydney,
is find a safe place to stay.
Just go back to civilization and pick a hotel, one with room service. We can make that our base of operation while we work on the next plan.
We researched that town specifically, she said. We can't go to some random place, at least not nearby. I doubt they took down my plates, but they could put out a call to look for this kind of car. If they've got that, and our descriptions, and it gets to the state police, it'll get to the alchemists, and then it'll...
Calm down, said Dimitri, touching her arm.
There was nothing intimate about that, but I still felt a spark of envy, particularly after the tough love I'd just had being nearly dragged through the woods.
We don't know that any of that's going to happen. Why don't you just call Abe?
Yeah, she said glumly. That's exactly what I want. To tell him I messed up the plan in less than 24 hours.
Well, I said, if it makes you feel better, the plan's about to change anyway.
Be quiet, she snapped. Both of you, I need to think.
Dimitri and I exchanged glances, but stayed silent. When I'd told him I knew a way to seriously help Lissa, he'd been intrigued. I knew he wanted details now, but we both had to wait for Sydney. She flipped on the dome light and produced a paper map of the state. After studying it for a minute, she folded it back up and simply stared ahead. I couldn't see her face, but suspected she was frowning. Finally, she sighed in that woeful way of hers, turned off the light, and started the car. I watched as she punched in Altswood, West Virginia, into her GPS. What's in Altswood? I asked, disappointed she hadn't entered something like Atlantic City.
Nothing, she said, pulling back onto the road. But it's the closest place to where we're going that the GPS can find.
A passing car's headlights briefly illuminated Dimitri's profile, and I saw curiosity on his face, too.
So, I wasn't the only one out of the loop anymore. The GPS read almost an hour and a half to our destination. He didn't question our choice, though, and turned back to me.
So what's going on with Lisa? What's this great plan of yours?
He glanced at Sydney.
Rose says there's something important we have to do.
So I gathered, said Sydney dryly. Dimitri looked back at me expectantly.
I took a deep breath. It was time to reveal the secret I'd been holding since my hearing.
So it, turns out Lisa has a brother or sister, and I think we should find them.
I managed to sound cool and casual as I spoke. Inside me, my heart lurched. Even though I'd had plenty of time to process Tatiana's note, saying the words out loud made them real in a way they hadn't been before. It shocked me, hitting me with the full impact of what this information truly meant and how it changed everything we'd all come to believe. Of course, my shock was nothing compared to the others. Score one for Rose in the element of surprise. Sydney made no attempt to hide her astonishment and gasped. Even Dimitri seemed a little taken aback. Once they recovered, I could see them preparing their protests. They would either demand evidence or simply dismiss the idea as ridiculous. I immediately jumped into action before the arguments could start. I produced Tatiana's note, reading it aloud and then letting Dimitri look at it. I told them about my ghostly encounter, where the Queen's troubled spirit made me believe there was truth to this. Nonetheless, my companions were skeptical.
You have no proof Tatiana wrote the note, said Dimitri.
The alchemists have no records of another Dragomir, said Sydney.
They each said exactly what I thought they would. Dimitri was the kind of guy always ready for a trick or trap. He suspected anything without hard proof. Sydney lived in a world of facts and data and had total faith in the alchemists and their information. If the alchemists didn't believe it, neither did she. Ghostly evidence didn't convince either of them. I don't really see why Tatiana's spirit would want to deceive me, I argued.
And the alchemists aren't all-knowing. The note says this is a pretty heavily guarded secret from Maroi. It makes sense it would be secret from the alchemists, too.
Sydney scoffed, not liking my all-knowing comment, but otherwise remained silent. It was Dimitri who pushed forward, refusing to take anything on faith without more evidence.
You've said before that it's not always clear what the ghosts are trying to say, he pointed out. Maybe you misread her.
I don't know. I thought again about her solemn, translucent face. I think she did write this note. My gut says she did. I narrowed my eyes. You know it's been right before. Can you trust me on this? He stared at me for several moments, and I held that gaze steadily. In that uncanny way of ours, I could guess what was going on. The whole situation was far-fetched, but he knew I was right about my instincts. They'd proven true in the past. No matter what he'd been through, no matter the current antagonism between us, he still knew me enough to trust in this. Slowly, almost reluctantly, he nodded.
But if we decided to search for this alleged sibling, we'd be going against Lisa's instructions to stay put.
You believe that note? Exclaimed Sydney. You're considering listening to it?
A flash of anger lit up within me, one I worked to hide. Of course this would be the next obstacle. Dimitri's inability to disobey Lisa. Sydney feared Abe, which I could kind of understand, but Dimitri's concern was still the lofty vow of chivalry he'd made to Lisa. I took a deep breath. Telling him how ridiculous I thought he was behaving wouldn't accomplish what I needed.
Technically, yes. But if we could actually prove she wasn't the last in her family, it would help her a lot. We can't ignore the chance, and if you manage to keep me out of trouble while we do it... I tried not to grimace at that. Then there shouldn't be a problem. Dimitri considered this. He knew me. He also knew I would use roundabout logic if need be to get my way.
Okay,
he said at last. I saw the shift in his features. The decision was made, and he'd stick to it now.
But where do we start? You have no other clues aside from a mysterious note.
It was deja vu, and reminded me of Lissa and Christian's earlier conversation with Abe when they were figuring out where to start their investigation. She and I lived parallel lives, it seemed, both pursuing an impossible puzzle with a sketchy trail. As I replayed their discussion, I attempted the same reasoning Abe had used. Without clues, start working through obvious conclusions. Obviously, this is a secret, I said. A big one. One people have apparently wanted to cover up. Enough that they'd try to steal records about it and keep the Dragomirs out of power. Someone had broken into an alchemist building and taken papers indicating Eric Dragomir had indeed been funding a mystery woman. I pointed out to my companions that it seemed very likely to me this woman was the mother of his love child. You could look into that case some more. Those last words were spoken towards Sydney. Maybe she didn't care about another Dragomir, but the alchemists still wanted to know who had stolen from them. Whoa, hey, how was I not even part of this decision process? She still hadn't recovered from our conversation suddenly running away without her. After the way our night had gone so far, she didn't look too pleased about being sucked into another of my rogue schemes. Maybe breaking Lissa's orders is no big deal for you two, but I'd be going against Abe. He might not be so lenient. It was a fair point. I'll pull in a daughterly favor, I assured her. Besides, the old man loves secrets. He'd be into this, believe me. And you've already found the biggest clue of all. I mean, if Eric was giving money to some anonymous woman, then why wouldn't it be for his secret mistress and child? Anonymous is the key word, Sydney said, still clearly skeptical of Zmei's leniency. If your theory's right, and it's kind of a leap, we still have no idea who this mistress is. The stolen documents didn't say. Are there other records that tie into the stolen ones? Or could you investigate the bank he was sending money to? The alchemist's initial concern had simply been that someone had stolen hard copies of their records. Her colleagues had discovered which items were taken, but hadn't given much thought to the content. I was willing to bet they hadn't searched for any other documents related to the same topic. She affirmed as much. You really have no idea how researching records works, do you? It's not that easy, she said. It could take a while. Well, I guess that's why it's good we're going somewhere, secure, right? I asked. Struck with the realization that we might need time to put our next step together, I could kind of see the disadvantage of having lost our out-of-the-way hideout. Secure, she shook her head. Well, we'll see. I hope I'm not doing something stupid. With those ominous words, silence fell. I wanted to know more about where we were going, but felt I shouldn't push the small victory I'd made. The victory I thought I'd made, at least. I wasn't entirely sure Sydney was 100% on board, but felt certain Dimitri had been convinced. Best not to agitate her right now. I looked at the GPS. Almost an hour. Enough time to check back on Lissa. It took me a minute to recognize where Lissa was, probably because I'd been expecting her to return to her room. But no, she was in a location I'd only been once. Adrian's parents' home. Surprising. In a few moments, though, I read the reasoning from her mind. Her current suite was in guest housing, and in the ensuing panic over my escape, her building was swarming with visitors now trying to leave. The Ivashkov townhouse,
situated in a permanent residential area, was a bit quieter. Not that there weren't a few fleeing neighbors there, too. Adrian sat back in an armchair, feet carelessly resting on an expensive coffee table that some interior designer had probably helped his mother choose. Lissa and Christian had just arrived, and she caught a whiff of smoke in the air that made her think Adrian had been sneaking in some bad behavior beforehand.
"If we're lucky,"
he was telling Lissa and Christian,
"the parental units will be tied up for a while and give us some peace and quiet. How rough was your questioning?"
Lissa and Christian sat on a couch that was prettier than it was comfortable. She leaned into him and sighed.
"Not so bad. I don't know if they're fully convinced we had nothing to do with Rose's escape, but they definitely don't have any proof."
"I think we got in more trouble with Aunt Tasha,"
said Christian.
"She was kind of pissed off that we didn't tell her what was going on. I think she probably wanted to blow up the statues herself."
"I think she's more upset that we got Dimitri involved," pointed out Lissa. "She thinks we screwed up his chances of ever being accepted again."
"She's right," said Adrian.
He picked up a remote control and turned on a large plasma screen TV. He muted the sound and flipped randomly through channels.
"But no one forced him."
Lissa nodded, but secretly wondered if she had forced Dimitri inadvertently. His dedicated vow to protect her was no secret. Christian seemed to pick up on her worry.
"Hey, for all we know, he never would have..."
A knock interrupted him.
"Damn," said Adrian, standing up. "So much for peace and quiet." "Your parents wouldn't knock," said Christian. "True, but it's probably one of their friends wanting to sit port and gossip about the terrible state of today's murderous youth,"
Adrian called back. Lissa heard the door open and a muffled conversation. A few moments later, Adrian returned with a young Maroi guy that Lissa didn't recognize.
"Look," the guy was saying, glancing around uneasily. "I can come back."
He caught sight of Lissa and Christian and froze.
"No, no,"
said Adrian. His transformation from grumpy to cordial had happened as quickly as a light switch being flipped.
"I'm sure she'll be back any minute. Do you guys all know each other?"
The guy nodded, eyes darting from face to face.
"Of course."
Lissa frowned.
"I don't know you."
The smile never left Adrian's face, but Lissa picked up quickly that something important was going on.
"This is Joe. Joe's the janitor who helped me out by testifying that I wasn't with Rose when Aunt Tatiana was murdered. The one who was working in Rose's building."
Both Lissa and Christian straightened up.
"It was a lucky thing you turned up before the hearing," said Christian carefully.
For a while, there'd been panic that Adrian might be implicated with me, but Joe had come forward just in time to testify about when he'd seen both me and Adrian in my building. Joe took a few steps back toward the foyer.
"I really should go. Just tell Lady Ivashkov that I came by, and that I'm leaving court, but that everything's set."
"What's set?" asked Lissa, slowly standing up.
She'll know."
Lissa, I knew, didn't look intimidating. She was cute and slim and pretty, but from the fear on Joe's face, well, she must have been giving him a scary look. It reminded me of the earlier encounter with Abe.
"Really?"
he added.
"I need to go."
He started to move again, but suddenly I felt a surge of spirit burn through Lissa. Joe came to a halt, and she strode toward him.
"What did you need to talk to Lady Ivashkov about?" demanded Lissa.
"Easy, cousin,"
murmured Adrian.
"You don't need that much spirit to get answers."
Lissa was using compulsion on Joe, so much that he might as well have been a puppet on strings.
"The money," Joe gasped, eyes wide. "The money's set."
"What money?"
she asked. Joe hesitated, as though he might resist but soon gave in. He couldn't fight that much compulsion, not from a spirit user.
The money. The money to testify about where he was.
Joe jerked his head toward Adrian. Adrian's cool expression faltered a little.
What do you mean, where I was? The night my aunt died? Are you saying...
Christian picked up where Adrian couldn't.
Is Lady Ivashkov paying you off to say you saw Adrian?
I did see him, cried Joe.
He was visibly sweating. Adrian had been right. Lissa was using too much spirit. It was physically hurting Joe.
I don't remember the time. I don't remember any of the times. That's what I told the other guy, too. She paid me to put a time on when you were there.
Adrian didn't like that. Not at all. To his credit, he remained calm.
What do you mean you told the other guy?
Who else? Repeated Lissa. Who else was with her?
No one. Lady Ivashkov just wanted to make sure her son was clear. I fudged the details for her. It was the guy, the other guy who came later, who wanted to know when Hathaway was around.
There was a click from the foyer, the sound of the front door opening. Lissa leaned forward, cranking up the compulsion.
Who was he? What did he want?
Joe looked like he was in serious pain now. He swallowed.
I don't know who he was. No one I'd seen. Some Maroi. Just wanted me to testify about when I'd seen Hathaway. Paid me more than Lady Ivashkov. No harm.
He looked at Lissa desperately.
No harm in helping them both, especially since Hathaway did it.
Adrian?
Daniela's voice rang down the hall.
Are you in here?
Back off, Adrian warned Lissa in a low voice. There was no joking in it. Her voice was just as soft, her attention still on Joe.
What did he look like? The Maroi. Describe him.
The sound of high heels clicked on the hall's wooden floor.
Like no one, said Joe. I swear. Plain. Ordinary. Except the hand. Please let me go.
Adrian shoved Lissa aside, breaking the contact between her and Joe. Joe nearly sagged to the ground and then went rigid as he locked gazes with Adrian. More compulsion, but much less than Lissa had used.
Forget this, hissed Adrian. We never had this conversation.
Adrian, what are you?
Daniela stopped in the living room's doorway, taking in the strange sights. Christian was still on the couch, but Adrian and Lissa were inches from Joe, whose shirt was soaked with sweat.
What's going on?
Daniela exclaimed. Adrian stepped back and gave his mother one of those charming smiles that captivated so many women.
This guy came by to see you, Mum. We told him we'd wait until you got back. We're going to head out now.
Daniela glanced between her son and Joe. She was clearly uneasy about the scenario, and also confused. Lissa was surprised at the heading out comment, but followed Adrian's lead. Christian did too.
It was nice seeing you, said Lissa,
attempting a smile to match Adrian's. Joe looked totally dazed. After Adrian's last command, the poor janitor had also probably forgotten how he'd ended up at the Ivashkov home. Lissa and Christian hastily followed Adrian out before Daniela could say much more.
What the hell was that?
Asked Christian once they were outside. I wasn't sure if he meant Lissa's scary compulsion or what Joe had revealed.
Not sure,
said Adrian, expression dark. No more cheery smile.
But we should talk to Mikhail.
Gross.
Dimitri's voice was gentle, bringing me back to him, Sydney, and the car. He'd undoubtedly recognized the expression on my face and knew where I'd been.
Everything okay back there?
He asked. I knew back there meant court and not the back seat.
I nodded, though okay wasn't quite the right word for what I'd just witnessed. What had I just witnessed? An admission of false testimony. An admission that contradicted some of the evidence against me. I didn't care so much that Joe had lied to keep Adrian safe. Adrian hadn't been involved with Tatiana's murder. I wanted him free and clear. But what about the other part? Some ordinary Maroi who'd paid Joe to lie about when I'd been around, leaving me without an alibi during the murder window? Before I could fully process the implications, I noticed the car had stopped. Forcing the Joe info to the back of my mind, I tried to take stock of our new situation. Sydney's laptop glowed in the front seat as she scrolled through something. "Where are we?" I peered out the window. In the headlights, I saw a sad, closed gas station.
"Altswood," said Dimitri.
By my estimation, there was nothing else but the gas station.
"Makes our last town look like New York."
Sydney shut her laptop. She handed it back and I set it on the seat beside me, near the backpack she'd miraculously grabbed when leaving the motel. She shifted the car into drive and pulled out of the parking lot. Not too far away, I could see the highway and expected her to turn toward it. Instead, she drove past the gas station, deeper into darkness. Like the last place, we were surrounded by mountains and forests. We crept along at a snail's pace until Sydney spotted a tiny gravel road disappearing into the woods. It was only big enough for one car to go down, but somehow, I didn't expect we'd run into much traffic out here. A similar road took us in deeper and deeper, and although I couldn't see her face, Sydney's anxiety was palpable in the car. Minutes felt like hours until our narrow path opened up into a large, dirt-packed clearing. Other vehicles, pretty old-looking, were parked there. It was a strange place for a parking lot, considering all I could see around us was dark forest. Sydney shut off the car.
"Are we at a campground?"
I asked. She didn't answer. Instead, she looked at Dimitri. "Are you as good as they say you are?"
"What?"
he asked, startled. "Fighting. Everyone keeps talking about how dangerous you are. Is it true? Are you that good?" Dimitri considered.
"Pretty good."
I scoffed. "Very good." "I hope it's enough," said Sydney, reaching for the door's handle. I opened my door as well.
"Aren't you going to ask about me?"
"I already know you're dangerous," she said. "I've seen it." Her compliment offered little comfort as we walked out across the rural parking lot.
"Why'd we stop?"
"Because we have to go on foot now." She turned on a flashlight and shone it along the lot's perimeter. At last, it flickered across a footpath snaking through the trees. The path was small and easy to miss because weeds and other plants were encroaching on it. "There." She began to move toward it.
"Wait,"
said Dimitri. He moved in front of her, leading the way, and I immediately took up the back position in our group. It was a standard guardian formation. We were flanking her the way we would a Maroi. All earlier thoughts of Lyssa flitted from my mind. My attention was totally on the situation at hand. All my senses alert to the potential danger. I could see Dimitri was in the same mode, both of us holding our stakes. "Where are we going?" I asked as we carefully avoided roots and holes along the path. Branches scraped along my arms. "To people I guarantee won't turn you in," she said, voice grim. More questions were on my lips when brilliant lights suddenly blinded me. My eyes had grown attuned to the darkness, and the unexpected brightness was too abrupt a change. There was a rustling in the trees, a sense of many bodies around us, and as my vision returned, I saw vampire faces everywhere. Chapter 9. Fortunately, they were Maroi faces. That didn't stop me from raising my stake and moving closer to Sydney. No one was attacking us, so I held my position. Not that it probably mattered. As I took in more and more of the setting, I saw that we were completely surrounded by about 10 people. We'd told Sydney we were good, and it was true. Dimitri and I could probably take out a group like this, though the poor fighting quarters would make it difficult. I also realized the group wasn't entirely Maroi. The ones closest to us were, but around them were Dampiers. And the light I'd thought had come from torches or flashlights was actually coming from a ball of flame held in one of the Maroi's hands. One Maroi man stepped forward, about Abe's age, with a bushy brown beard and a silver stake in his hand. Some part of me noted the stake was crudely made compared to mine, but the point held the same threat. The man's gaze passed over me and Dimitri, and the stake lowered. Sydney became the object of the guy's scrutiny, and he suddenly reached out for her. Dimitri and I moved to stop him, but other hands reached out to stop us. I could have fought them, but froze when Sydney let out a strangled, "Wait!" The bearded Maroi gripped her chin and turned her head so that the light fell on her cheek, lighting up the golden tattoo. He released his hold and stepped back.
"Lily girl,"
he grunted. The others relaxed very slightly, though they kept their stakes poised and still looked ready to attack if provoked. The Maroi leader turned his attention from Sydney to Dimitri and me.
"You're here to join us?"
he asked warily.
"We need shelter," said Sydney, lightly touching her throat. "They're being chased by the Tainted."
The woman holding the flame looked skeptical.
"More like spies for the Tainted."
"The Tainted Queen is dead," said Sydney.
She nodded toward me.
"They think she did it."
The inquisitive part of me started to speak but promptly shut up, wise enough to know this bizarre turn of events was best left in Sydney's hands. I didn't understand what she was saying. When she'd said Tainted were pursuing us, I thought she was trying to make this group think we had Strigoi after us. Now, after she'd mentioned the Queen, I wasn't so sure. I also wasn't so sure identifying me as a potential murderer was that smart. For all I knew, Brownbeard would turn me in and try to score a reward. From the looks of his clothes, he could have used one. To my surprise, this brought a smile to his face.
"And so another usurper passes on. Is there a new one yet?"
"No," said Sydney. "They'll have elections soon and choose."
The group's smiles were replaced by looks of disdain and disapproving mutters about elections. I couldn't help myself. How else would they choose a new king or queen?
"In the true way,"
said a nearby Dampier.
"The way it used to be, long ago, in a battle to the death."
I waited for the punchline, but the guy was clearly serious. I wanted to ask Sydney what she'd gotten us into, but by this point, we'd apparently passed inspection. Their leader turned and began walking down the path. The group followed, moving us along as they did. Listening to their conversation, I couldn't help a small frown, and not just because our lives might be on the line. I was intrigued by their accents. The motel's desk clerk had had a thick southern accent, exactly like you'd expect in this part of the country. These guys, while sounding similar, had a few other pronunciations mixed in. It almost reminded me a little of Dimitri's accent. I was so tense and anxious that I could hardly focus on how long we've walked. Eventually, the path led us to what seemed like a well-hidden campground. A huge bonfire blazed in a clearing with people sitting around. Yet, there were structures scattered off to one side, stretching into the woods along the now widened path. It wasn't quite a road yet, but it gave the illusion of a town, or at least a village. The buildings were small and shabby but appeared permanent. On the other side of the fire, the land rose sharply into the Appalachians, blocking out the stars. In the flickering light, I could see a mountain's face that was textured with rough stone and scattered trees, dotted here and there with dark holes. My attention moved back to the living. The crowd gathered around the fire, a couple dozen or so, fell silent as our escort let us in. At first, all I saw were numbers. That was the warrior in me,
counting opponents and planning for attack. Then, just like I had earlier, I truly took in the faces. More Maroi mixed with Dompierre's, and I was shocked to discover, humans. These weren't feeders, either. Well, not in the sense that I knew feeders. Even in the dark, I could see glimpses of bite marks along some of the humans' necks, but judging by their curious expressions, I could tell these people didn't give blood regularly. They weren't high. They were mixed in among the Maroi and Dompierre's, sitting, standing, talking, engaging. The whole group clearly unified in some kind of community. I wondered if these humans were like the alchemists. Maybe they had some sort of a business relationship with my kind. The tight formation around us began to spread out, and I moved closer to Sydney. What in God's name is all this?
The Keepers, she said in a low voice.
Keepers? What does that mean?
It means, said the bearded Maroi, that unlike your people, we still keep the old ways, the way we truly should.
I eyed these keepers in their worn clothes and the dirty barefoot children. Reflecting upon how far we were from civilization, and based on how dark it was away from the fire, I was willing to bet they didn't have electricity. I was on the verge of saying that I didn't think this was how anyone should truly be living. Then, remembering the casual way these people had spoken about fights to the death, I decided to keep my views to myself.
"Why are they here, Raymond?" asked a woman sitting by the fire.
She was human but spoke to the bearded Maroi in a perfectly ordinary and familiar way. It wasn't the dreamy manner a feeder usually used with a Maroi. It wasn't even like the stilted conversations my kind had with the alchemists.
"Are they joining us?"
Raymond shook his head.
"No. The Tainted are after them for killing their queen."
Sydney elbowed me before I could deny the claim. I clenched my teeth, waiting to be mobbed. Instead, I was surprised to find the crowd looking at me with a mix of awe and admiration, just as our welcoming party had.
"We're giving them refuge,"
explained Raymond. He beamed at us, though I didn't know if his approval came from us being murderers or if he simply liked the attention he was getting.
"Although you are welcome to join us and live here, we have room in the caves."
"Caves?" I jerked my head toward the cliffs beyond the fire, realizing now what those black holes were. Even as I watched, a few people retiring for the night crawled off and disappeared into the dark depths of the mountain. Sydney answered while I worked to keep a look of horror off my face.
"We only need to stay here,"
she faltered, not surprising considering how sketchy our plans had become.
"A couple days, probably."
"You can stay with my family," said Raymond. "Even you."
That was directed towards Sydney, and he made it sound like quite the favor.
"Thank you," she said. "We'd be grateful to spend the night at your house."
The emphasis on the last word was for me, I realized. The wooden structures along the dusty path didn't look luxurious by any stretch of the imagination, but I'd take one over a cave any day. The village, or commune, or whatever, was getting increasingly excited as our novelty sank in. They bombarded us with a flurry of questions, starting with ordinary things like our names, but moving quickly on to specific details about how exactly I'd killed Tatiana. I was saved from having to answer when the human woman who had spoken to Raymond earlier jumped up and steered my threesome away.
"Enough," she said, chastising the others. "It's getting late, and I'm sure our guests are hungry."
I was starving, actually, but didn't know if I was in dire enough straits to eat opossum stew or whatever passed as food around here. The woman's proclamation was met with some disappointment, but she assured the others they could talk to us tomorrow. Glancing around, I saw a faint purpling of what must have been the eastern sky. Sunrise. A group of Maroi clinging to traditional ways would most certainly run on a nocturnal schedule, meaning these people probably only had a few more hours before bedtime.
The woman said her name was Sarah, and led us down the dusty path. Raymond called that he'd see us soon. As we walked, we saw other people wandering near scattered, ramshackle homes, on their way to bed or possibly woken up with all the commotion. Sarah glanced over at Sydney.
"Did you bring us anything?"
"No," said Sydney. "I'm just here to escort them." Sarah looked disappointed but nodded.
"An important task."
Sydney frowned and appeared even more uneasy.
"How long has it been since my people brought you anything?"
"A few months," said Sarah after a moment's thought.
Sydney's expression darkened at this, but she said no more. Sarah finally took us inside one of the larger and nicer looking of the houses, though it was still plain and made of unpainted wooden boards. The inside was pitch black, and we waited as Sarah lit old-fashioned lanterns. I'd been right. No electricity. This suddenly made me wonder about plumbing. The floors were hardwood like the walls and covered in large, brightly patterned rugs. We appeared to be in some hybrid kitchen-living-dining room. There was a large fireplace in the center, a wooden table and chairs on one side, and large cushions on the other that I presumed served as sofas. Racks of drying herbs hung near the fireplace, filling the room with a spicy scent that mingled with the smell of burnt wood. There were three doors in the back wall, and Sarah nodded to one.
"You can sleep in the girls' room," she said.
"Thanks," I said, not sure I really wanted to see what our guest accommodations were like. I was already missing the motel. I studied Sarah curiously. She looked to be about Raymond's age and wore a plain, knee-length blue dress. Her blonde hair was pulled back and tied at her neck, and she seemed short to me the way all humans did.
"Are you Raymond's housekeeper?"
It was the only role I could deduce for her. She had a few bite marks, but obviously wasn't a feeder. At least not a full-time one. Maybe around here, feeders doubled as household help. She smiled.
"I'm his wife."
It was a mark of my self-control that I managed any sort of response.
"Oh."
Sydney's sharp eyes fell on me, a warning in them. "Let it go." I again clenched my jaw shut and gave her a brief nod to let her know I understood. Except, I didn't understand. Dompierre's Maroy hooked up all the time. Dompierre's had to. More permanent liaisons were scandalous, but not completely out of the realm of possibility. But Maroy and humans? That was beyond comprehension. Those races hadn't gotten together in centuries. They'd produced Dompierres long ago, but as the modern world progressed, Maroy had completely withdrawn from intermingling, in an intimate way, with humans. We lived among them, sure. Maroy and Dompierres worked alongside humans out in the world, bought houses in their neighborhoods, and apparently had bizarre arrangements with secret societies like the Alchemists. And of course, Maroy fed from humans. And that was the thing. If you kept a human close to you, it was because they were a feeder. That was your level of intimacy. Feeders were food, pure and simple. Well-treated food, yes, but not food you became friends with. A Maroy having sex with a Dompierre? Racy. A Maroy having sex with a Dompierre and drinking blood? Dirty and humiliating. A Maroy having sex with a human? With or without blood drinking? Incomprehensible. There were few things that shocked me or gave me offense. I was pretty liberal in my views when it came to romance, but the idea of human and Maroy marriage blew me away. It didn't matter if the human was a type of feeder, as Sarah appeared to be, or someone above that, like Sydney. Humans and Maroy didn't get together. It was primitive and wrong, which was why it was no longer done. Well, at least not where I came from.
"Unlike your people, we still follow the old ways."
The funny thing was that no matter how wrong I thought all this was, Sydney had to feel even more strongly about it with her vampire hang-ups. I supposed she'd been prepared, however,
which is why she could manage that cool expression of hers. She hadn't been blindsided like Dimitri and me, because I felt with some certainty that he shared my feelings. He was just better at hiding surprise. A commotion at the door startled me out of my shock. Raymond had arrived and wasn't alone. A Dampier boy of about 8 or so sat on his shoulders, and a Moroi girl about the same age scurried alongside them. A pretty Moroi woman who looked to be in her 20s followed, and behind her was a cute Dampier guy who couldn't have been more than a couple years older than me, if not exactly my age. Introductions followed. The children were Phil and Molly, and the Moroi woman was named Paulette. They all appeared to live there, but I couldn't exactly figure out the relationships, except for the guy my age. He was Raymond and Sarah's son, Joshua. He had a ready smile for all of us, especially me and Sydney, and eyes that reminded me of the piercing crystalline blue of the Ozeras. Only whereas Christian's family tended to have dark hair, Joshua's was a sandy blonde with lighter gold highlights. I had to admit, it was an attractive combination. But that stunned part of my brain reminded me again that he'd been born from a human Moroi hookup, not a Dampier and Moroi like me. The end product was the same, but the means were bizarre.
"I'm putting them in your room," Sarah told Paulette. "The rest of you can share the loft."
It took me a moment to realize the rest of you meant Paulette, Joshua, Molly, and Phil. Glancing up, I saw there was indeed what looked like a loft space covering half the house's width. It didn't look big enough for 4 people.
"We don't want to inconvenience you,"
said Dimitri, sharing my thoughts. He'd been silent for almost all of this woodland adventure, saving his energy for actions, not words.
"We'll be fine out here."
"Don't worry about it," said Joshua,
again giving me that pretty smile.
"We don't mind. Angeline won't either."
"Who?" I asked.
"My sister."
I repressed a grimace. 5 of them crammed up there so that we could have a room?
"Thank you," said Sydney. "We appreciate it, and we really won't be staying long."
Their dislike of the vampire world aside, alchemists could be polite and charming when they chose.
"Too bad," said Joshua.
"Stop flirting, Josh," said Sarah. "Do you 3 want something to eat before bed? I can warm up some stew. We had it earlier with some of Paulette's bread."
At the word stew, all my opossum fears came racing back.
"No need," I said hastily. "I'd just be fine with bread."
"Me too,"
said Dimitri. I wondered if he was trying to reduce their work or if he shared my food fears. Probably not the latter. Dimitri seemed like the kind of guy you could throw into the wilderness and he would survive off anything. Paulette had apparently baked a lot of bread, and they let us have a picnic in our small little room with a full loaf and a bowl of butter that Sarah had probably churned herself. The room was about the size of my dorm room at St. Vladimir's, with 2 down-stuffed mattresses on the floor. Quilts neatly covered them, quilts that probably hadn't been used in months with these temperatures. Munching on a piece of bread that was surprisingly good, I ran my hand over one of the quilts. "It reminds me of some of the designs I saw in Russia," I said. Dimitri studied the pattern, too.
"Similar, but not quite the same."
"It's the evolution of the culture," said Sydney. She was tired, but not enough to abandon textbook mode. "Traditional Russian patterns brought over and eventually fused with a typical Americana patchwork quilt form."
"Whoa.
Good to know." The family had left us alone while they got ready for bed, and I eyed our cracked door warily. With the noise and activity out there, it seemed unlikely we'd be overheard, but I lowered my voice anyway.
"Are you ready to explain who the hell these people are?"
She shrugged.
"The keepers."
"Yeah, I got that. And we're the tainted. Sounds like a better name for Strigoi."
"No."
Sydney leaned back against the wooden wall.
"Strigoi are the lost.
You're tainted because you joined the modern world and left behind their backward ways for your own messed-up customs.
Hey, I retorted, we're not the ones with